Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
I'm ready to blow with just one more sound.
Brain Injury Radio and Radio Ability are sponsored by the TBI Network.
Find them on facebook.com/TBI Network or at tbisn.org.
Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week, and now, for tonight's episode of Brain Injury Radio.
Hello, guests out there, and Michelle, my special guest. Tonight, we're going to have a really interesting conversation. We're going to be talking about something that a lot of people know something about, but not a lot. And hopefully, Michelle is going to tell us everything we ever wanted to know about the gut-brain connection. She's a naturopathic doctor, and she's going to help us understand the interaction between the brain and the gut. She will discuss the connection between our metabolism, the foods we eat, and the central nervous system. This is not something new, but our understanding of this connection is one thing that is driving our understanding of what we eat and the connection with our mood from what we eat. Our gut contents can often cause or clear neuropsychiatric problems. We can improve our memory, our stress response, our balance, and our decision making by the simple step of improving our gut. Our age is something that we can't really change. But I'm sure you've noticed that age affects different people differently. It becomes less of a determinant of our health with an improvement in diet, exercise, our medications, and probiotic supplements. And Michelle, I'm sure, is going to mention the special one that her company puts out, Omnibiotic Stress Release. The genes we inherit from our parents are stable, but other genes, our microbial genes, can change throughout our lives. The number of human to microbial cells is considered to be about 1-to-1. Although microbial genes certainly outnumber ours by a great degree. This means that our moods, decision-making, and memory are greatly influenced by what we put into our guts. There's a physical barrier between the gut and the body to prevent infection, but sometimes this protective layer can be compromised. Most of us have heard of leaky gut, but Dr. Maddox is here to tell us how to prevent that and help increase our mental, our physical, and our psychological health. So, Michelle, would you like to say hello to everybody?
Hi, everyone. I'm glad that you could tune in this evening.
Thank you.
I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I want to start out by asking you, what is the microbiome?
Yeah, so it's a great question because this term microbiome is something that is literally everywhere. It was on the cover of Time. It's kind of thrown around. And when you get right into the conversation about it, it seems like a lot of people don't quite understand actually what we're referring to. So the microbiome is not just the microbes themselves, but it's also what they make and what the host makes in response to those products that are made by the microbes as well as the microbes themselves. So it actually is really quite complicated. I kind of refer to it as the whole soup of all of the stuff that's there.
Okay.
And we have multiple microbiomes, which is something I think that we also tend to overlook. We focus a lot on the gut microbiome, which is huge and it's key and it's probably one of the biggest, but we also have a skin microbiome, we have an oral microbiome in our mouth, we have the gut microbiome. There are actually several different microbiomes within and on our bodies.
Very interesting. So we kind of can't get very far away from it, can we?
Not and stay alive, actually. It's really quite important. They do so many things for us. And our microbiome produces so much for us. You know, for this particular conversation, we're focusing predominantly on the gut microbiome because it's that gut-brain connection and leaky gut and that type of a thing. However, all of the microbiomes actually do things for us, and it's this beneficial symbiotic relationship that we have with them. As far as the gut microbiome goes, you're absolutely right. There's, you know, roughly a one-to-one ratio bug-to-host cells, but when you start looking at the genes, which is within our DNA, we are more bug than us, frankly.
And, well,
and I know, right? And some people, it's good, right? We have these, typically when we're talking about the gut microbiome, especially we talk about this term commensals. And I always think about commensals as being part of our community. And these are the bugs that we have in our gut that we need there. They actually help us be healthier. They produce things like short chain fatty acids. They help us break down our foods and assimilate our nutrients. They help us activate certain medications, as well as some vitamins that we take in are completely reliant on these specific individual bugs within our commensals or within our community. And we want that to be nice and robust and healthy. And you mentioned in the intro, this concept of we have this barrier to prevent a translocation between, you know, quote unquote, bad bugs into the rest of our body. And that's 100% true. Most people, I think, when they start thinking about the microbiome, it's a little bit of a mental shift because they're so used to thinking about bacteria and viruses and fungi and those types of things as being bad and causing disease, and we don't want them. But that's not necessarily true. Those are actually, you know, there are less of those out there than there are commensals.
So this whole new way of thinking about what's in us.
Yeah, it's a whole new way of thinking about what's in us and what we put into us, because these commensals or our microbes, they need to be fed to stay healthy and to continue to reproduce and populate. And one of the ways that they help maintain a healthy microbiome is by crowding out those bad players. So those, you know, something that's a nasty bug that might be on, you know, the food that you ate today. If you have a good, healthy microbiome, you have a higher chance that you will actually not get sick because they will crowd that bug out. They'll wall it off. They actually have things that they secrete that will kill the bug, and you will pass it through your body and not be any the wiser if you have a good, healthy, robust GI microbiome. And
okay.
Yeah, so the microbes, you know, I mentioned these short-chain fatty acids. These are what our microbes create by digesting and breaking down the foods that we're eating. And these short-chain fatty acids are essential. They have the ability to up and down regulate our immune system, as well as inflammation, as well as actually directly kill other organisms by changing the pH, by changing how those organisms are received within the body. They also, if you don't have a healthy microbiome and you have these microbes that are considered opportunistic, which means just like it sounds, right? If you give them the opportunity, they are going to be bad players. If you don't give them the opportunity, the commensal, that community kind of holds them in check. So these particular microbes, they create things that are associated with more harm within our bodies. So things like something called lipopolysaccharides or LPS. And this is typically viewed as bad, and it's been associated with a ton of issues within us, mostly related to higher inflammatory states. It's highly pro-inflammatory. And then we also have other type of compounds that bacteria create, like TMA and TMAO, which have been strongly associated with cardiovascular risk. And so you want to have this balance within your GI microbiome. It needs to be nice and robust with these commensals, so any opportunistic organisms that you may have residing in your gut don't have the opportunity to misbehave. And if you happen to ingest a pathogen, you are less likely to be sick because there's nowhere for them to go. They can't actually adhere to the wall of the intestine or get inside the body because the commensals won't let them. They'll crowd them out.
Well, that's good news then.
If you have a healthy gut microbiome, yeah. And if you're feeding it, you know, it's difficult to have a healthy gut microbiome if you're not feeding it the things that keep it happy. And typically speaking, our microbes like fiber. The, you know, complex carbohydrates are indigestible carbohydrates. And so those are, you know, we talk about things like inulin from onions and garlic. We talk about all of our brands. You know, this is where we start talking about things like FOS and some things that you see when you're looking at typically probiotic supplements or fiber supplements. That's why they're there, because it feeds those bugs and helps them to thrive within the environment.
Okay, I have a question here. I know several people who are allergic to onions and garlic. The first time I heard that, I was like, what? But what do these people do?
So those are two examples of sources of inulin. Another source of inulin is chicory, which is often in coffee substitutes. It tastes really nice if you've never tried it. I actually really love it. There are a ton of supplements out there. And I personally am a fan of having the prebiotic supplement, which is what we're talking about. Those are your inulins and your FOS and your fibers, basically. Those are prebiotics. I tend to prefer those dosed separately from probiotics, because sometimes if you are not used to having a lot of fiber, it can, and then you suddenly put a lot of fiber into your body, sometimes it can create a little bit of gas and bloating, and people tend to not be super comfortable with that until their body's gotten used to it. I like to dose those separately, and I tend to tell people to take them right before bed, because usually you will then sleep through the gas and the bloating, and by the time you get up in the morning, you're right as rain. Yeah, onions and garlic are just one. There's always, the beautiful thing about food sources is that there are almost always multiple options. Those are some of the most common, and most people are good with that. But there are definitely people who don't do well with them. I personally don't like onions, and so I choose to get my inulin from other things.
Okay. So why should we be concerned about our microbiomes?
Yeah, so our microbiome does so much for us. It not only helps us with that regulation of other microbes trying to come into our system, it also to the rest of our body. There's this thing, exactly what you alluded to at the beginning, which is the gut-brain axis. The gut-brain axis is one of many gut axes in the body. There's gut immune and gut liver and gut brain and gut skin. But for the purposes of today, we're really honing in on that gut brain. And there's a literal direct connection via the vagus nerve, which runs from the brain to the intestines. And it's a two-way communication. The brain sends signals down to the gut that then control things like how much the gut is moving, how fast things are going through it, what are the gastric secretions that are coming out, what are some of the products that are coming out, and then the gut sends signals back up to the brain via that nerve. And it does that through a lot of these byproducts that are coming from our microbiome acting on what we put into our body in the form of food or fiber, but also other microbes that are coming into the body.
Hmm.
So when we talk about this gut-brain communication, obviously the vagus is kind of the heart of that. It's that central connection. But it really, really regulates things like how permeable our gut is, and it regulates how our immune system within our gut function. It can turn on, so these short-chain fatty acids that are made by microbes in the gut, when they act on food, they can turn on or turn off immune cells that say, this thing right here is us, leave it alone, or this thing right here is not us, and attack it. And so if there's an imbalance in that gut-brain connection, if there's an imbalance in the products that the microbes are putting out, then we send a signal back up saying, now we're on high alert. And now, you know, the motility to our gut has been slowed down. The leakiness has been tightened, right? It's this two-way communication. We also have receptors in the lining, in the wall of our gut for CRF, which is something that releases catecholamines. And so when these receptors are stimulated, then our body sends the message that we need catecholamines. And these are things like epi and norepi and those types of things, right? These are those excitatory, which is how we start then leading into anxiety and depression and the impact that our microbiome can have on those things.
Okay. Very interesting. So what causes a person's microbiome to change? I mean, I mentioned food, medication, all that stuff, but like, what causes a person to suddenly change?
Yeah, there are a number of things that could change your microbiome. There's obviously an illness, right? If you are exposed to some form of a pathogen, it's going to come in and it's going to really wreak havoc with the balance of commensals in your gut. Antibiotics or any form of an antimicrobial, frankly, even botanical antimicrobials can change the balance of microbes in your gut. Stress changes the balance of microbes in your gut, and it changes what they put out as their byproducts. It changes whether they're putting out epinephrine or whether they're not putting out epinephrine, whether they're making serotonin, right? The large majority of serotonin that we make is made in our gut. And if we don't have the right microbes, we don't make the right amount of serotonin, which is the precursor for a ton of other things, right? That's the target of those SSRIs, which are antidepressants. If we have imbalances in our microbiome, we can have this thing called leaky gut, right? Which is your gut. I always explain it to people that your gut is kind of like a colander. So if you think about a colander that you use to strain spaghetti, if anybody eats spaghetti, hopefully people know this reference. So if you have a good colander, those holes are small and they let the water out, but they hold all of the noodles or all of the rice or whatever you're straining. They keep it within the colander. But over years or with abuse, right, if you bang it around, if you put it in the dishwasher when you're not supposed to, if you come at it with a knife to scrape the sides, those holes get bigger. And now when you dump the pot of water and noodles into it, you lose noodles, not just water. And that same thing happens in our gut when we have leaky gut. So there are things in our gut, they're called tight junctions, and they're supposed to be tightly woven together, as the name implies. And if you are, you know, if your gut is in distress, those tight junctions get leaky. They start to move apart. They start to allow things through that shouldn't be allowed through. And that's when you start to have these, you know, high levels of food sensitivities. You think about things like autoimmune disease because you have pieces that are never supposed to leave your gut that are now actually into your body and your immune system is going haywire. And ways that we can harm our gut, potentially leading to something like leaky gut, are by not nurturing a good healthy microbiome. So, you know, putting foods into our body that don't help our gut microbiome survive. So things like never eating fruits and vegetables and complex carbohydrates give your body fiber. If you've got a diet where you do not take in fiber and you are not supplementing fiber, your commensals, your microbiome doesn't have any food to stay alive and be healthy. And so now you have this lack of commensals. If you are eating things that are potentially harmful to you, so if you have a food sensitivity, if you if you have celiac disease, but you continue to eat gluten or you're exposed to gluten without recognizing where it's coming from, now you are damaging the lining of your intestine and you're leading to leaky gut. Medications have been known to do it, especially a lot of antimicrobials. We have people who, self-diagnose and pop an antibiotic anytime they have a sniffle. That will definitely hurt your microbiome because you're basically killing everything all the time. Lots of generally things that we all know we shouldn't do. So things like poor sleep, not enough water, eating badly, that laundry list of things that we all know we should do, but we sometimes struggle to do them. Those will all negatively impact your gut microbiome, which then negatively impacts how healthy those tight junctions are and how well the GI tract, which is basically just a tube in the middle of your body, how well that stays just a tube in the middle of your body, only allowing certain select small things through. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And I was wondering, if someone sets out to fix their leaky gut, I mean, how long would something like that take?
It's a great question. And the answer, unfortunately, is it depends. So it depends on how badly their gut has been beaten up, right? And it also depends why. So I have friends who have gut issues secondary to chemotherapy. And that takes a very long time to start to help that person versus a person who has leaky gut and permeability issues because they eat, meat that's full of antibiotics. They never eat fruits and vegetables. And if they do, they're, cooked to looking like a cooked noodle. They don't eat fiber. They, you know, they don't sleep well. They're high stress. They don't drink water. They only drink soda. You know, the list, like, and we all know it's that standard American diet. If that's the diet, then, you know, depending upon how motivated they are to fix it, actually can be something that happens in the grand scheme of things in a relatively short period of time. You know, I always talk to people about how long did it take you to get here, and recognize that it, you know, if it's been 15, 20 years in the making, it may take a few months to start to feel better. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So
this is something that a person can fix for themselves by doing the right thing.
Absolutely. They can fix by eating well, right? Switching the standard American diet. So coming into having good macro. So macros are your proteins, your carbohydrates, and your fats. So we need all of those things, but we need them from healthy, clean sources. So choosing to the best of your financial ability, protein sources that don't have antibiotics. Right, the non-commercial meats and those types of things. Carbohydrates that come from complex sources, so vegetables and beans and, you know, your not highly processed or refined carbohydrates, so no sugars, those types of things. Fruits are great. Vegetables are great as long as you're actually eating it and not just drinking the juice. I tend to laugh and kind of say, you know, a prolonged juice diet is a really healthy way to become a type 2 diabetic. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, some juicing or, you know, periods of juicing is great, but you need to balance it. And then, you know, coming in with probiotics, and typically speaking in our world, we do need some level of a supplement because we're just not getting those from playing outside in the dirt or having them on our food. And, you know, we wash our foods, which is what we should do, frankly. I'm not saying don't wash your foods, do wash your foods, play outside in the dirt and then wash your hands. But we just don't have the same exposures that people had, you know, 100 years ago. And so taking in probiotics gives us highly specific and targeted and viable organisms. Most of the companies who produce probiotics have done so because there's a reason that they're putting this particular organism in this product. And so, for example, omnibiotic stress relief or omnibiotics products across the board, those particular probiotics have been heavily studied to produce a very specific result and to survive the gastric tract, so get through the incredibly high acidity of the stomach and all the gastric juices in the intestines to actually get into where they need to be to help the person and to start making all of these other products that we need them to make to help us with our gut-brain axis and gut-immune axis and all of those other things.
So we can improve our immune system by improving our diet.
Absolutely. And it's the direct improvement of we need nutrients. And I'm a fan of food first and supplement second for pretty much anything. However, there have been a ton of studies that have shown that our soils don't have the same level of nutrients in them that they used to. And so if you eat a carrot now, it doesn't have the same vitamin content that a carrot, you know, 50 to 100 years ago had, or 20 years ago, frankly. And so, you know, having a good, healthy diet gives you the nutrients that you need to power your body. Everything that happens in our body is 100% dependent upon a nutrient to make it happen. So we need them. And by giving your body what it needs, it has the fuel and the power to actually function. You know, it's one of the things that I hear people say when they go from standard American diet to a diet that is more colorful, which is how I tend to encourage people. I don't follow any particular dietary pattern. You want variety and you want lots of color and you want your macronutrients. So you're looking for nutrient density, right? You want a lot of nutrients in what you're eating. And one of the first things that I start to hear from people is, one, that whole thing around, gosh, that's a lot of food to eat. when you hear that conversation around, I can eat, the comparison of calories and nutrients in a salad versus calories and nutrients in two donuts, right? Salad actually is a huge amount of food. But there's also, they tend to have more energy. They tend to have less brain fog. They tend to find that they are, because they're eating better, they're feeling better physically because they're finally starting to give their body the nutrients and the other substances that the body needs to function in an optimal way. And now suddenly they have the ability to go for a walk, even if it's just 5 minutes, which gets them outside, which also helps with brain fog and helps clear their head and lower stress and anxiety and depression and all of those types of things. So to me, that diet and having a colorful, nutrient dense, meeting the needs of macronutrients for the person is really, really fundamental for healthy life, period, and especially for a good healthy microbiome, which you need for a good gut brain axis.
That's great. Okay, so I notice here in my introduction something I got from something you said, but an improvement diet helps determine our microbiome, but so does an improvement exercise. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so when we exercise, it does a couple of things for us. It moves our body, which helps us move our bowels. It's like this kind of massage of our bowels. And that's very important because, as I tell my kids, going to the bathroom, whether it is peeing or whether it is pooping, it's your body's way of taking out the trash. And you have to do that. If you don't take out the trash, you can think about it in your house. Think of a time when, for whatever reason, you didn't take out the trash past when it should have been taken out. It was stinky, it was nasty, it was gross, and it was just kind of like this. Well, your body takes out the trash by pooping, by peeing, by breathing, sweating, crying, etc. But the main way that the body does it is via feces. And so if you exercise, it is a very, very, very easy way to help alleviate sluggishness in your bowels because now you are massaging them and now they're moving and you're starting to push that stuff out. If you don't have regular bowel movements, you run the risk of reabsorbing all of these things that your body has packaged to be excreted. And it was trash the first time around. You don't want to take it back up and recirculate it again, right? And so that's one of the things that exercise does for us. It helps keep us regular, which is extremely important. You have to take out the trash. The other thing that it does for us is it releases all sorts of chemicals in our body. And again, this is triggering that gut-brain connection as well as a ton of other things. But now we have endorphins, and now we are starting to feel better and perceive better. One of the things that I always talk about with people is, we have a ton of stress in our lives. It's how our lives are today. And it's incredibly difficult to control the amount of things coming at you. If you get this, like, I think everybody filters it out now when someone says, "Oh, reduce your stress." And it's kind of like, sure, how am I going to do that? Thanks a lot. That was really not helpful. I don't know how to reduce my stress, right? And so what I tend to say is it isn't about reducing your stress. It's about changing how you handle it, because we're always going to have stress, and there has always been stress. If you think about how we talk about what we call our sympathetic nervous system, it's our fight or flight response, which is triggered by stress. And it's called the fight or flight response because all of these chemicals in our body are released in response to stress that are meant to help us fight, like fight the tiger, or run from the tiger, right? Because traditionally that's what we were dealing with. We were stressed because someone wanted to fight us, or holy cow, there's a tiger chasing me. Now it looks different. We're sitting in our car stuck in traffic and we're going to be late for a meeting, or someone says something that we disagree with and it makes us really angry, or our partner forgot to take the trash out, right? It's all of these things, and they trigger the same chemicals as being chased by a tiger. Our brain doesn't actually know the difference. The biggest difference, though, is in the sense, in the time that you're actually chased by a tiger, you use those chemicals to physically run away. Whereas when you're sitting in your car, pissed off and upset because you're going to be late and you're going to miss a meeting or whatever, now you're not getting rid of those chemicals by running, you're stewing in them. And that's unhealthy. And so when you exercise, you physically get rid of all of those chemicals that are coming into you that your body is producing in response to stress. Now you're doing something, you know, you may actually be running. You may not be. You may be going for a walk. You may be hitting a heavy bag. You may be, you know, doing some other form of exercise. But all of them have the effect of getting rid of all of those stress chemicals and allowing you to free yourself from that, which is why we feel better mentally and emotionally after we exercise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Yeah, so just, but you can exercise too much, just like you do anything too much.
Absolutely. Balance is key with really anything. I mean, you know, I have a son who I can't believe I have to say it, but I actually have to say, son, you have to eat something besides just broccoli. Because he will sit down and eat a ton of broccoli, and then he's full and he doesn't want anything else. So some broccoli is good, but he needs other nutrients besides what broccoli is giving him. And so even good things can be bad. I know, it's a weird conundrum as a parent to have. So, exercise in moderation. Don't hurt yourself because now you've gone the other way. But if you... either you yourself are trained or you're working with someone who is a well-trained trainer or guide, some level of physical activity, frankly, on a daily basis, move your body, right? Our bodies were made to move. They were not made to sit. And move them, and it helps from a physical, mental, and emotional standpoint, most definitely. And I found with not just myself, but with the people that I work with clinically, once they get moving, it's this feed forward positive feedback type of a thing where once they get moving, they're more motivated to eat better. Once they eat better, they're more motivated to get moving. And so there's this really positive feed forward cycle that I have found. And then, you know, it does absolutely come back to that microbiome, and that you have, now you're taking out the trash, and now you are giving your microbiome the fuel that it needs to be happy and healthy. And so now you're making more serotonin, and now you're making more of the catecholamines, and you are having this really good balance of getting what you need when you need it and starting to fill in the gaps in your microbiome, fill in the gaps in the commensal community, and start to heal. Even it can help heal that leaky gut, because there are members in the commensal community that actually make some of the mucus that helps to seal those tight junctions and keep them nice and healthy.
Hmm. Well, that's pretty interesting stuff. I noticed you don't have anything here about, like, meditation, that form of stress relief.
So, it wasn't a conscious oversight. It's something perhaps I just didn't talk about it yet. So meditation, some level of mindfulness is extremely important and extremely helpful from a stress release perspective. We need to physically release all of those chemicals by moving our bodies, but we also, it's hard to change how we handle stress and how we process stress if we don't do some level of mindfulness. And, you know, it could look like meditation, like a formal type of a meditation practice. For some people, yoga is meditative. For some people, walking is meditative. For some people, doing a journal or a gratitude exercise or something, doing something that brings a level of awareness into your thoughts and how you physically feel in your body and what is happening there is extremely valuable.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to, it's interesting because I work with people across the spectrum of beliefs and orientations. And for some people, the term meditation is actually something that they don't like. They have this avoidance to it. It's not accessible to them. And they get into either they're wary of it because they feel like they can't do it because of their religion, or they feel like, oh, I did that once and I wasn't good at it, right? They feel like they're not good at meditation. And so, you know, what I tend to tell people is, you know, do the guided meditation, do the journaling, you'll find something. But the other part of this mindfulness and the stress release that we can get out of mindfulness comes from also bringing joy into your life. And whatever that looks like for you, maybe it is playing with your dog. Maybe for you, it's going for a walk. Maybe it's yoga. Maybe it is meditation for you. But some level of joy on a daily basis can have a huge impact on the level of gratitude you have for yourself and others and how you view the world around you, which has amazing beneficial impact on your longevity and your mental and emotional outlook.
Very nice. Yeah. And for a lot of people, exercise is a form of meditation.
Absolutely. Especially, you know, your long-term runners, they get into this space, right? They get into this headspace.
Yeah.
Some people use walking like that. I do yoga, and I know that at some point within my practice, it becomes a meditation of the breath, right? So exercise can absolutely be a form of meditation for some people. And for some people, meditation is the very formal meditation exercise that we're all, you know, that picture that we all have in our head of what meditation looks like. That for some people, that's perfect and it works really well.
But we're all different.
We all are different. And it's important to recognize that there's no one right answer, that there are multiple ways to achieve the desired outcome. And everybody's different. And frankly, where you are in your life in that moment is not where you're going to be in your life tomorrow, for Pete's sake. So recognize that there are multiple options for how you can achieve some of these things. One of the things that is extremely important and not quite as flexible is sleep, which we haven't talked about. And it is so very important to brain health in general and your physical health, as well as that gut-brain connection. You know, when you're sleeping, your body gets that chance to rest. Your digestive tract kind of gets down-regulated a little bit. It still works, but it has this, I always think about it as that's the time that your body goes around and kind of cleans, your immune system kicks up a little bit. You have a little bit of a higher body temperature as your enzymes start to kick off and burn off anything that shouldn't be there. The same thing happens in your GI. You have a kick up of your immune system. You have a slowing down of things moving through your GI tract so that they have the ability to properly process. And you need, for good brain health and for good health in general, the average is 8 hours consistently every night and in one fell swoop, which means that it needs to be in a chunk of 8 hours. Having 4 hours at night and then a 2 hour nap and then another 2 hour nap you don't get that long period of rest. You need that chunk so that your body can go through multiple cycles, all of the delta and the alpha waves and the REM sleep, and you need multiple cycles of those to actually have the maximum benefit for your body. And that's probably one of the few things that I would say is not super flexible. You can't get super creative around how you're going to make up your hours.
Because I heard that, you know, before lights, you know, lanterns or whatever became very popular, you know, people would go to sleep when the sun set and get up when the sun rose. And often it was like 4 hours, and then it'd be up for a couple hours, and then 4 more hours.
It's interesting. Genetically, there are people who are predisposed to being the two sleepers. There's a technical term for that that's escaping my brain right this second. But those are the people who do that. They go to bed when the sun goes down, but usually right about midnight, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, they wake up. And
yeah.
They're up and they go back to the fire, right? And they congregate around the fire, historically speaking. And then they go back to bed and then the sun comes up a couple hours later. That's a genetic predisposition that not everybody has. Just like there are some people who are genetically predisposed to be late sleepers, which means that they actually do not start to get tired. They do not need to go to bed when the sun goes down. They are the ones who historically would stay up while everybody else was sleeping, and they would tend the fire and they would keep watch. And then when the two sleepers came out, then they would go to bed. But they also wouldn't get up when the sun came up. And so you've got... It's interesting because genetically we have multiple predispositions for how we sleep, and there is a predisposition for short sleep. However, there are biochemical and physiologic ramifications of that short sleep. And so even that person who is more genetically prone to shorter periods of sleep or the two sleep, they will have ramifications if they don't within, you know, however long, still get a chunk of roughly 8 hours.
Very interesting. Yeah, because sometimes I just find myself, I just wake up in the middle of the night and I'm just unable to sleep no matter what. And I'll just get up and, you know, read or something. I find that often helps. But, you know, it's like sometimes my body just does not want to sleep, and I can't force it to sleep. I mean, taking melatonin helps, but, you know, only to a certain extent. So, Michelle, did we lose you? I think we did lose you, Michelle. Okay, we'll wait a few minutes and wait till she calls back, and I'll give her another chance to call back. In the meantime, I can put on a little music for us, nice calming, relaxing music. because that can only help. That can only help our moods. So I will put on Purple Planet Languidity. Purple Planet is the group and Languidity is the song. I will put that on right now. We'll listen to the song for a couple minutes and then we'll Michelle, I just say we can listen to this for a little while and then a couple minutes. Talk about relaxing and with a song. So, Michelle, you were talking about sleeping.
Yeah.
I was afraid you'd fall asleep here.
Oh, no. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just fine.
Okay, good. Sorry about that. My phone dropped. I live a little bit out in the desert, and sometimes that happens. So at the end of the day, one of the biggest things about sleep is what do you feel like when you wake up? Do you feel rested and recharged and rejuvenated? Or are you tired still? If you are still tired, then you are either not getting quality sleep or you're not getting enough sleep or some combination of those two things. And, you know, the 8 hours is an average. Some people need 7. Some people need 10. A lot of that depends on age and activity and health and those types of things. It's one of the reasons that we sleep more when we don't feel good, right? Our body needs that rest and rejuvenation.
Right. Right. I know right after my head injury over 30 years ago, but I slept like 15, 16 hours a night for a little while mm-hmm. there because my body just needed so much help getting mm-hmm. through that.
Absolutely. And again, whether it's a traumatic brain injury, whether it is an illness, you know, sleep is one of the things that our body uses to rejuvenate ourselves. And so it's super important. And we definitely feel it when it's missing, when it is not a good high quality.
Brandy, okay, I want to ask you a question. I have heard one answer, but I've been hearing some other things. Is it better to go to bed on an empty stomach or a full stomach?
Most of the research that I have seen showed that it is better to go to bed on perhaps not a completely empty stomach, but definitely not a full stomach. Usually when you go to bed with a full stomach, you tend to have indigestion. And your GI at night when you're sleeping, it's down-regulated. It doesn't work as well. And so now you put this meal into it during a time when your GI is supposed to be resting. And therefore, it doesn't have the opportunity to rest, or the food stays there, which now we're back to the not able to take out the trash effectively analogy. So the flip of that, of course, is for a lot of people, going to bed on an empty stomach is also bad. You know, one of the first things that I ask anybody who suffers from migraines is, do you go to bed on an empty stomach? Do you wake up in the middle of the night hungry? If either of those two answers are yes, then one of the therapeutics is have a small snack that has high quality protein and high quality fat before bed. Not a large, but like a little snack. And in the large majority of people, that is transformational with their migraines. Doesn't always do it, but it helps a ton of people. Yeah. And so you have a little bit, right? You're not already depleted. You have enough fuel to get you through the night, but you're not demanding so much of your GI. That's where you start to get indigestion, if you have a full meal and then go to bed.
Very interesting. So you should eat a little bit.
Most people do better with a little bit. There are some people who can go to bed on an empty stomach and they have no problem with it. But for those people who cannot do that, then a little bit of protein and a little bit of fat, because then it has longevity. That will tend to help them get through the night and wake up, sleep a little bit deeper, have a higher quality of sleep, and wake up a little bit more rested.
Very nice. Okay. Well, Michelle, before we go any further and these other questions I need to ask you, I want to say if anyone is listening to this show live and has a question they'd like to ask Michelle about leaky gut or the microbiome or whatever, please call in number 424-243-9540. That's 424-243-9540. And after you do that, press the number 1. I'm looking at the switchboard here, and I'll see a little question mark come up beside your name or come beside your call number. I wonder who it is, and I'll know that you have a question. Otherwise, Michelle, why don't you tell people how to get in touch with you before we go on?
Sure. So you can find me on LinkedIn, Dr. Michelle Maddox. You can find me on Facebook as Soaring Phoenix Consulting. I am a naturopath, and I also do healthcare consulting for healthcare startups in the integrative and functional medicine space. And you can also go to my website, soaringphoenix.net, when it is fixed. Right now it is down. So Facebook and LinkedIn are the two best places.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's very good. Now, back to the going to bed. What happens? I mean, like for me, no matter what time I go to bed, I just cannot sleep more than 6 hours, no matter how much I try.
Do you wake up feeling rested?
Yeah. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't, but then once I get up and moving, I feel rested.
So you may be someone who is genetically predisposed to short sleep. And for you,
okay.
6 hours may be adequate. 6 hours may be adequate. If you aren't finding that you are waking up rested, then kind of going through this process of, do you need a little snack before bed? Are you maintaining good oxygen levels through the night? You need to do some level of, you know, brain dump before you go to bed. Is it you're waking up, you know, I say that, you laugh at that, but, you know, I wake up early in the wee hours of the morning, and often I can't go back to sleep because I'm thinking about all the things that I have to get done.
Yeah.
And then I might as well just get up and start doing them, you know?
Yeah.
And on the one hand, you know, you may be more productive, but on the other hand, eventually you will burn out. And that's not good either. So there are lots of tricks that you can use if you find that while you wake up at 6 hours, you are not actually rested and you may need more if that's a common or recurring thing.
Hello?
Did I lose you again?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, now okay. We can hear you.
So yeah, it's... You know, it very much depends on the individual, as with everything else. There's not a one-size-fits-all for, frankly, anything.
Yeah, and it was probably because of my head injury too. I mean, I used to sleep like a baby, and then, you know, now it's been years and years after my head injury, and all of a sudden I can't sleep worth a darn.
Yeah, and there are some studies that have been done post-traumatic brain injury with sleep and disrupted sleep, and that is definitely something, if you're interested, you may kind of look into that literature to see if they've found anything that, and it may be that you can do some small adjustments to other things and improve the quality of sleep that you do get. And so maybe it is that 6 hours is adequate, but now you're sleeping more deeply and you do feel more rested.
Mm-hmm.
It's such an individual thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, most of us need this chunk of many hours of sleep to be healthy and thrive and feel rested and for our bodies to work properly.
Well, that's something that I was wondering about, because some people say, oh, yeah, I sleep, you know, when you add it all together, it's 8 hours, but it's, you know, several times throughout the day. It's like, is that good or not? Well, maybe not.
Yeah, the studies that have been done on that type of a sleep pattern tend to show that that is not actually healthy for your body. And the participants who have that type of a sleep pattern tend to have, you know, poor immune response. They tend to have a higher risk of cardiovascular diseases. They tend to have a higher risk of mental and emotional imbalances. It really does come with some pretty serious and quite a host of things to only have short chunks of sleep, even if they total up to 8 hours.
Isn't good. Okay, well, that's good to know. That's definitely good to know. I'll say, nope. Guess I knock you out or something, yeah.
Or, you know, melatonin until you can reset yourself. It's been interesting. There have been a couple really interesting studies about people who go camping, or they send a study group out into the wilderness with no artificial lights, period, end of conversation. No lanterns, no nothing.
Yeah.
And after about 3 or 4 days, most people's sleep cycles have reset to be shortly after the sun goes down, and they get up very near to when the sun comes up. And they've kind of re-regulated that circadian rhythm within their bodies because they don't have the opportunity for any external light sources or any other stimulus to mess it up.
Hmm. Okay. And another thing, I know that one of my friends, she was a nurse, and she was an on-call nurse on the night shift.
Yeah.
Well, I think she developed diabetes, and they told her it was from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of, so we are made, our bodies, our circadian rhythm is attuned to light dark phases. So melatonin, which you've mentioned a few times in this conversation, melatonin is the hormone your body makes that tells you to sleep. It's what puts you to sleep, right? And it is only made in the absence of light.
Mm-hmm.
And then cortisol, which is our get up and go, that is made, it starts to, you know, as melatonin, we get to the peak of the night, that 2 to 3 o'clock, that's our peak melatonin, and it starts to come down. And then our cortisol starts to rise, so that our cortisol, which is the thing that gets us up and out of bed, or theoretically it would get us up and out of bed if we didn't have alarms and all of these other things, then cortisol actually peaks right about the same time that the sun comes up for the greater majority of people in the greater majority of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's that's how our bodies regulate. That's how our hormone cycles are regulated, is through this melatonin only made at night when it's dark, and cortisol kicks up during the day when it's light outside. And so when you're forcing yourself to go against your circadian rhythm, there are a number of issues that people have found. And diabetes, type 2 diabetes is one of them, hypertension and or high blood pressure and other types of cardiac issues are another. They are often people who struggle with depression and anxiety. They tend to struggle with weight. Your body is supposed to light and dark cycles. And when we start to mess with that, then there tends to be some ramifications in our health. And especially if you have someone who's on call, like you're talking about with your friend,
yeah.
She's on call, but she's not necessarily always working at night. And so then you start to run into shift workers who, well, sometimes they're awake all night and then they sleep during the day, but then other times they try to be awake during the day and then sleep at night because they need to interact with people who are on that schedule. And that gets even harder to work with, and they tend to have even more health issues.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the truth. So tell me, you know, I've heard looking at the computer before, mm-hmm. you know, for an hour or two, they tell you to turn it off an hour or two before you go to sleep. I know it's the light that goes off the computer, but why is that going to harm you?
So, again, we come back to melatonin. Melatonin is made in the absence of light, and there are certain light waves mess up our body's ability to make melatonin more than others. And blue light, which is what we get from our screens, impacts our body's ability to produce melatonin the most. The red light spectrum tends to impact our body's ability to make melatonin the least. And so, you know, I work with people who have children and they talk about needing night lights. And unfortunately, a large number of night lights are blue, right? So as you're going through, So now you're putting in your kid's bedroom this blue night light and wondering why they're not sleeping. Well, you're or in your bedroom or in your hallway, but it shines into your bedroom, you know, those types of things. So if you have to have night lights, I tend to recommend going for those red or orange colors. They're a little difficult to find, but you can find them or you can be creative. We use aromatizers that have lights on them, and then we just lock it in at the red as our night lights in our house, and it works really well. But that's why they tell you to shut down screens before, at least a couple of hours before you go to bed, because that blue light can suppress your body's ability to make melatonin, and so you need to avoid it and then give your body the chance to make the melatonin. Does that make sense?
Very interesting. Very interesting. Okay. That's good to know. I mean, yeah, because I was wondering, you know, they say all this electromagnetic light is going to affect your ability to sleep. I'm like, I don't know. Sometimes playing solitaire on the computer is what puts me back to sleep. Because
and
it's just bored playing a stupid game. But
mm-hmm. Yep. And to me, when I hear somebody say that, I tend to think that it makes me wonder if that's what they need to be able to shut their brain off, right, to stop their brain from running a million miles an hour. And I wonder if there might be another way to achieve that. And even if it is going back to, you know, buy a deck of cards and play solitaire with the actual cards, or read a book, not on a Kindle, like those types of things that would potentially, or meditate before bed, right? perhaps some of those types of things, do some, you know, restorative yoga, go for a dental walk, like something like that, that also would have the effect of giving your mind permission to shut down.
Yes. That's probably a big part of it, giving your mind permission to shut down.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I you're really amped up with it. I have to do this, I have to do that. Oh my goodness. Mm-hmm. How am I gonna get everything done? You know?
Yeah. Absolutely.
You need something telling you, stop already.
Yeah. You need to give yourself that permission.
Yes. And so I noticed here, looking at some of the stuff you said that I wrote down here, and decision-making ability, is that really dramatically impacted by what we eat?
So if we are making decisions under stress, right, if we are making decisions when we have had a flood of these biochemicals and these hormones and neurotransmitters that are produced by microbiome and are triggered by external triggers like stress, and stress can absolutely be poor diet, right? Stress looks like many things. Then we're not thinking clearly. We're not, it's like we're kind of always being in a fog, right? Mm-hmm. And so to have the clear-headedness, then, you know, we want to make sure that we are giving our bodies what it needs to recognize when it's safe. You know, I think that people tend to focus on stress as these, I have so many deliverables and I'm stuck in traffic and I have these timelines and I have so much that I have to get done and that kind of stress. And they forget that, yes, that's absolutely one sort of stress. However, there are a number of different types of stress. There's the stress of not enough sleep. If you've ever been sleep deprived for chronic length of time, it is extremely stressful. If there's the stress of nutrition, of poor nutrition. So some people, it's very extreme and it goes to, you know, food scarcity stress, right? But it can also be your body's reaction to never getting its nutrient needs met. And so you have these people who have, you know, they have an abundance of food. However, it isn't actually food. They're not getting, they're not nourishing themselves. And now your body is stressed up because it is scrambling to build nutrients with very minimal building blocks. Or, you know, you don't have a healthy microbiome because you're constantly popping antimicrobials or you never eat fiber. And now, you know, you've got a leaky gut and you are now having translocation of bacteria and translocation of other substances, which is triggering your immune system to attack these things. And now your immune system is going haywired and you're chronically inflamed. And when your body that is chronically inflamed, you tend to have brain fog, you tend to have pain, you tend to not think super clearly. So yes, it's 100% all connected.
Okay. So does being around other people, like a family, does that help in the general stress response of the body?
I think it depends on the person. I've seen mixed studies, and I've looked at this a little bit, not a ton. So you're getting a little bit of me looking at research and then a little bit of me and working with people. And being in an environment where they're part of a group is actually stressful. For other people, that isn't necessarily the case. I would absolutely say that it very much depends on the group of people. If you are around even if you're around your family, if it is not a healthy and loving and nurturing environment,
right?
I don't care if you're the type of person who has to be surrounded by people, that's not good for you. However, even if you are a person who does better with long periods of alone time and silence, if you have a few people in your life that you can have those moments with and have that connection with, it does feed us and it does feed our soul. We are predominantly, with very few exceptions, we are not meant to be alone. We are fundamentally pack animals. We are clan people. And if you can find your group, your people, whether that is family or friends or whatever, that is, you can have this healthy relationship with. They feed you, they nurture you, it's a healthy and positive interaction, then yes. But that isn't hands down necessarily always the case. It has to be just being around people isn't what is beneficial. It is the relationships that you have with the people that you spend time with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true, because some families are much closer and more nurturing than other families.
Absolutely. And I have people in my life that I call family, and they are friends who are family. And I'm blessed and I have a really awesome family, and I am blessed and I have really awesome and amazing family, who's family that I got to pick. And it's important. Those relationships that feed us and nurture us, they're important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Very interesting. Yeah, because I've never been one to have a lot of people around me, but, you know, I do need a few people around me who I can really count on.
Exactly. And, you know, it's kind of that cliche of it isn't the quantity, it's the quality.
Yeah.
You can be in a room full of people and feel very alone and not nurtured. Versus you can be in a room with one other person and be really very content.
Okay, very interesting. Okay, one last thing I wanted to ask you about was depression.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the connection with that, I mean, some people, it can be completely helped by diet and exercise. Some people, it can't, obviously. But how do the two, food and our microbiome and depression, how do they play into each other?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, our neurotransmitters, so these are things, right, they're neurotransmitters. They go between our brain, right? They function as talking between things. There are hormones. There are things like serotonin. And they are key. We make the large majority of serotonin in our gut, and it is made by microbes acting on certain foods. And so if we do not have a good, healthy microbiome, and we do not have the right foods, then we don't have the levels of neurotransmitters which help us feel happy, and they allow us to feel joy. And now we start to have too few of those, or we process them differently. And so making sure that you've got the right amount of food in our system, in your system, as well as making sure you have the right type of microbes. And one of my favorite studies about probiotics was done actually on the product, the stress release product by Omibiotic, and they put people into an fMRI. And so an fMRI, and I'm sure you're familiar and your listeners are familiar, the fMRI is an MRI, and they ask people a series of questions, or they show them, you know, pictures or whatever, and they're taking pictures of the brain and the functioning of the brain the entire time. And they gave this particular group of individuals this probiotic stress release that is formulated specifically to help with stress, depression, and anxiety. And they gave this probiotic for four weeks when they redid the fMRI. So they redid the same questions in the pictures. And what they found was that there was an improvement in this thing called the salience network. And that particular network is responsible for attention and perception and our cognition. And they found this decreased connectivity or decreased activity in the default mode network. That network is responsible for distraction, rumination, impaired decision-making and reasoning. And then they also gave them questionnaires. They gave them a PANAS questionnaire, which is trying to get at positive and negative affect and symptoms of depression. And what they found was that after this 4 weeks of this probiotic, there was a significant decrease in hopelessness and in risk aversion. And they had the people who participated in this study had a noticeably and significantly more positive affect. And again, you're feeding your microbiome, which is then allowing, giving your body the substances that it needs to create the adequate amount of neurotransmitters, like your serotonin, for example. And it was just a probiotic. They didn't do anything else different in their life. They didn't do any of the other stuff that we've talked about in this conversation. They didn't change sleep. They didn't get exercise. They didn't change their diet. They didn't do any of those things. They just took a probiotic that was targeting an anxiety and depression, and they had significant positive benefit. And now, for me as a practitioner, I get really excited because I can give them this probiotic, which I know is going to help them, and now I can also help them change their diet, and I can get them to exercise, and I can help them with mindfulness exercises and all of these other things. So now we really have so many different tools to help someone who's struggling with hopelessness and ruminating thoughts and difficulty making decisions and depression and anxiety. We have some really highly effective, but at the end of the day, fairly simple tools to have large impacts on these individuals.
That's very good to know because, yeah, if someone's really depressed, I mean, it's easy to just help them right here and now.
So many
tools. To some degree.
I am in no way, shape, or form downplaying the role of therapy and all of those things because they're all tools that a lot of people need to help them with depression. And if you can come in with microbiome support to try to optimize neurotransmitters and reduce inflammation and food so that your body has the nutrients that it needs and you're not worried about leaky gut and exercise so that you get moving and you get to expel all of these other chemicals that come through your body in response to stress. And now you're sleeping, so your body has time to regenerate and rest and renew. You bring this multifactorial approach in for an individual, and you can get some really amazing results.
That's really neat to hear. That's very good news that you make that much difference. Because what I've used in the past, I found that sunlight is very helpful for improving my mood when I just get in the, it's like, I'm going to be really depressed. I'm really feeling down right now. I found that sunlight really helps me a lot with that.
Absolutely. And sunlight, again, you're getting out there, you're getting your vitamin D. You are having, usually when you're getting sunlight, you're doing it outside. So now you're changing your scenario. You're changing where you are. You're getting fresh air. And there's absolutely, you know, our bodies are designed to be asleep when it's dark and awake when it's light. And that kick of sunlight helps to really reinforce that. And, you know, it's hugely important to know that about yourself, to know that when I'm going down this place, if I step outside and lift my face to the sun and take a few moments to breathe that in, I tend to snap out of that.
Yeah, exactly.
But, yeah.
But then I really
That's a huge thing.
I really feel for those people. My husband's children, my stepchildren, who live in Alaska, and they live far up north that in the winter time they have like maybe half an hour of sunlight a day.
Mm-hmm. Seasonal affective disorder seasonal affective disorder is awful. It's definitely a thing. It's why they have those full spectrum lights. And people tend to end up needing additional vitamin D. They, it can be really, really tough. The flip of that, I lived in Oregon for a few years. And in the winters, it was really difficult because the sun was down. It was completely dark by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And the sun come up again until, 9 o'clock in the morning. And it was never actually up. It was always kind of gray, right? The flip of that, though, is in the summers, the sun was up until easily 10 o'clock at night and then back up again by 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And so it was a really interesting dichotomy, and there's this interesting mentality of soaking it all up while you can because you know it's going to go away for several months. But that's where those full-spectrum lights and stuff come in, and they're really, really important.
Yeah. But apparently so are these probiotics from that study you told me. I mean, that's really good news because it's rainy weather sometimes. You don't have any sun at all. I mean, there is a way to deal with it.
There is a way that you can absolutely help yourself by feeding your microbiome, which then supports, making neurotransmitters, of which serotonin is the one that I've said a ton. That's the one. It's one of the big hormones that helps with mood stabilization. It helps us feel happy. It's one of those things that gives us a general sense of well-being, and it also regulates our sleeping and our eating and how we digest things. And the large majority of that comes from our microbiome, our gut microbiome. And it's a simple thing, right? A good, high-quality, targeted probiotic and enough fiber and prebiotics to feed them, and it's huge.
Yeah, I never heard of prebiotics until a couple years ago. I started reading about it, and all of a sudden, I was like, why haven't I ever heard of this before?
It's really, to me, it's very interesting because as we have the science to understand more of how things work, now we have all of these new words that we didn't have decades ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's really cool and it's very exciting. And there are definitely those moments of, wait a minute, why didn't I know about this before?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Wonder, has this always been around? Gee,
Yeah, it has always been around. It was called fiber. We used to, now we know more about it and we can supplement it and we know specifically which types of fiber are better and so on. Yeah.
Yeah. So chewing on some leaves and stuff all day is a very good thing.
Yeah, something along those lines. I'm not sure about that specifically, unless you are a koala. However, a good, colorful, diverse diet is one of the best things that you can do for your microbiome and your body in general.
Yes, you said that. So, I try to do that. And sometimes, it really makes you happy to look at a really colorful meal,
It does. It's a work of art on your plate.
Yes.
And we eat with our senses. We, we see it, we smell it, we taste it. It's appealing to more of our senses when it is bright and colorful and there's different textures. And it's just something that the more senses we can bring into it, the more we enjoy it usually.
Yeah, that's why a complete juice diet isn't good for very long.
it's one of the reasons. Yeah, it's one of the things that can be problematic with a juice diet, yeah. And you're missing all of the fiber when you juice. You juice it out. You concentrate all those sugars.
Yeah.
So for short periods of time, they can be helpful and restorative, or as a supplement to a good healthy diet, it can be healthy and restorative. But as a longer term, it can potentially be problematic. Or if that's the only way that fruits and vegetables are in the diet, it can be problematic.
Yeah, I was just reminding me for some bizarre reason, but this guy I know, you know, from a chiropractic conference, you know, I've been talking to him and I've seen him around, but it's like he was very into detoxification of the liver. Why would that be so incredibly relevant to everything we do?
So your liver is the detoxification powerhouse of your body. It is how we convert things to be excreted in our feces or our breath or whatever. And it's how we build up, how we get rid of things that are potentially harmful to us. So, you know, we want to make sure that our liver functions as well as it can. And one of the ways that people do that is by doing some form of a liver, you know, quote-unquote detoxification, which tends to be full of things that are liver supportive and nutrients that the liver needs to work well and botanicals that help the liver work even better and those types of things. I mean, at the end of the day, I feel pretty strongly that you should have a lifestyle that you don't need to detoxify from as much as possible. So, right. That's across the board, right? You take things into your body that you're not super worried that they're going to be highly toxic, you know, toxicant in your body. Now,
right.
We live in a world where it's hard to 100% avoid toxins, right? There's stuff in the air. There's stuff in the furniture that we bring into our homes. You know, like even when we do our best, we are definitely exposed. And so some level of detoxification support, whether that is a you know specific time of year or several times a year that a person does that, whether they do some low level of detoxification support always, it looks different depending upon the person and the life. But ultimately, we can't avoid those toxins. However, we can completely have huge impacts on how much of that stuff that we actually are exposed to and take into our bodies to minimize how much we have to detoxify.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you recommend not putting yourself in the position where you have to detoxify, you know, all the time.
Yeah, it's the same. Yeah, because it's a detoxification, you know, quote-unquote liver detoxification. You're going to be exposed to things. You can't avoid them. You just can't. Even if you go live off in the woods, you're still breathing the air that is not as clean as it needs to be for you to be healthy, right? You're going to have some level of exposure. However, if you minimize the toxins that are in your food and you minimize the toxins that you put on your body in the form of personal care products, if you minimize the toxins you bring into your home by being mindful about the furniture that you bring in and being mindful of what you're tracking in on your shoes and the products that you use in your home, you've lowered your threshold, right? You've lowered the amount of toxic burden that you are exposed to, and now you're giving your body some support there, and it doesn't. You've kind of allowed yourself to go longer, right? You have a lower amount of toxins coming in, so you don't need to detoxify as much because you're simply not as exposed to as many things. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Because that's what I keep telling myself. It's like, oh, I don't need to detoxify. I'm doing things about right. But, you know, every once in a while you should clean things up, make sure.
And again, our world is not pristine.
Yeah, it's not.
You know, you go outside, and while the air, most studies will show that the air outside of your home is actually higher quality than the air inside most people's home, not, you know, that's assuming that they're doing nothing to help their indoor air quality. You know, even with pristine air outside, there are still toxins in the air. There are still, even with the best organic choices in your food and your products and so on, you will be exposed. There's just really no way to avoid it. But you can minimize your exposure.
Well, that's kind of good news. Yeah. I mean, I look at it and say, well, I'm pretty healthy. I never catch anything that comes around. And, you know, so I'm in pretty good shape. But maybe so, maybe not, you know.
You know, it's hard to say. Our immune system needs a good clean house every now and again. And one of the ways that our immune system cleans house is by getting sick and mounting a fever and burning everything through. And, you know, it's something that we should expect to do every now and again. And it's hard because we're busy and we don't really have time. And it sucks. It's not fun to be sick at all. Talk about stress.
Yeah. They say fevers are really good for you, and, you know, but good Lord, you know.
Fevers are good for you. And obviously, there's a threshold, right? It's everything within reason. So really high fevers actually are not good for you. You want to help bring that down. However, you know, a good, healthy fever, it's the immune system. Your body is kicking up its internal temperatures to kill whatever it was that made you sick in the first place. And if you don't allow that to happen, that's where we tend to run into these lingering illnesses, or now we've got the secondary illness, because we didn't allow our body to get rid of the offending agent in the first place by mounting a fever and burning it up.
Yeah, that's what I tell you with antibiotics. Always take the full dose, you know, the full course.
Absolutely. You may feel better, but it isn't gone. Finish the antibiotic. And even though you start to feel better, don't jump back into your life business as usual. Still, you know, there's this period of time that people used to talk about and we don't anymore, and it's that convalescent, right? That I'm convalescing. I was sick and I'm getting better, but I'm not better yet. I'm still convalescing. Right. I am still being gentle with myself. I'm still allowing myself extra sleep, and I'm still allowing myself to be as stress-free as I can. I'm still recovering, and we don't allow that for the most part anymore.
No, we don't, because we're so busy. We're running from one thing to another.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want anything to interfere. Yeah.
We don't have time. We don't have time to be sick, and we certainly do not have time to convalesce.
Sounds kind of funny, just, you know, someone just says it like you just did. Yeah, but that's true. That's true. One last question here. I mean, I was told that you never, when you're taking probiotics every day, I heard that you stop taking them when you're taking an antibiotic. Is that the case or no?
No. Usually you do not want to stop taking them when you're taking probiotics, or sorry, when you're taking an antibiotic.
Yes.
You do want to take them at least 2 or 3 hours apart.
Oh.
And so you don't want to kill the probiotic, right?
Right.
And if you take the probiotic and the antibiotic at the same time, the chances are that the antibiotic will kill the probiotic. However, that antibiotic, it's doing its job. And antibiotics are usually really very good at doing their job. They go in and they kill microbes. Now, imagine, again, coming back, you know, kind of bringing it full circle to what we started talking about at the beginning, you have a community of microbes in your gut, and they help keep you healthy, and they help prevent leaky gut. They help keep that barrier nice and tight so that things do not translocate into the body causing inflammation. And when you impact the commensals, your microbiome, in a way where you're killing them, now you have allowed those opportunistics, those microbes that you need a little bit of them, but you need them to stay in check. If they get too big within your microbiome, now they're going to cause problems. And now when you get rid of commensals, which often happens with antibiotics, you've opened up the lane for those opportunistics to thrive because there's nobody there keeping them in check. And so when you take probiotics with an antibiotic a couple hours apart, now while you are definitely coming in and doing some damage to those commensals, you're also giving it back. And so now you're minimizing that collateral damage.
Okay, that's good to know. I was wondering about that. Yeah, thank you.
We get that question a lot. And there's also Omnibiotic has a couple of products that are specifically formulated for people who are on antibiotics. And so one of them is called AB10. And there are really quite a few studies on that particular product in patients who are on antibiotics. And they took their antibiotic, and then 2 or 3 hours later, they took the probiotic, and they had significantly less side effects from the antibiotic, right? Because often people, when they're taking antibiotics, they get diarrhea, they get nausea, they get stomach upset. And the probiotics helped minimize the incidence of those things.
Very interesting. Okay. Okay, that's good. Good to know. Yeah. Huh. So what other useful pearls do you have for us as we're closing down this show here?
Oh, goodness, that's such a open and loaded question. You know, I think bringing it back full circle to that gut-brain axis and what we started off with is this whole concept of the microbiome and a good, healthy, and robust microbiome is fundamental to general overall health and well-being in ways that I think that we just don't really tend to think about a lot. And the fact that so many of our neurotransmitters are made by our microbiome and our gut, and we have the ability to impact that in a positive way by taking a good, high-quality, targeted probiotic, by making sure that we have a colorful diet with a variety of foods and a good amount of fiber and supplementing with prebiotics when we need to, it's this fundamental level of health and this fundamental level of caring for ourselves that then allow us to thrive as a human being. And it's super duper simple.
Okay, we can all just go out and do that starting tomorrow, right?
Order the probiotic. Flip the diet, get some sun, and sleep. That's the fundamentals.
Okay. Sounds good. So do you want to talk about, I mean, I never even asked you this, but any really successful cases you've had?
From a GI perspective, I think that the one that comes up to me is a particular individual who did have GI changes post chemotherapy, abdominal chemotherapy, and you know there's a structural issue there, and that is something that you know this particular individual will have issues probably for the large you know. for the rest of their life because structurally there's damage that can't be repaired. However, they were experiencing a a high degree of loose stool and incontinence with their stool and a large degree of just, you know, nausea and indigestion and just overall very uncomfortable. And they did some minor dietary tweaks where they paid attention to things that they ate that seemed to trigger these types of things.
Mm-hmm.
But for them, that didn't quite have the same impact. That's one of the first things that most people do. They pull, right? You think about removing foods. And usually it has a really good impact. But for some people, you don't get the impact you expect. And for this particular person, that was and so then coming in with GI repair type of a protocol. So there are a myriad of products out there that have prebiotics in them, so the inulins and the FOSs, and then they have botanicals in them that actually help to replace the mucin or that the mucilaginous lining of the gut while you are repairing the microbiome, because your microbiome is the one that makes that mucus that protects the wall of your intestines. And so working with this particular individual to do this group of supplements while also working with them to pay attention to the amount that stress triggered some of their episodes. And that was actually fundamentally it. And they will probably for the rest of their life have some level of GI because of the chemotherapy to the abdomen and the damage that was done to their intestines through that. They had significant improvement in quality of life by doing a prebiotic and a probiotic and some mucilaginous herb products that were specifically targeting GI repair, and then noticing what was I thinking, what was I doing, what was I worried about right before I had this episode, and recognizing that mind-body connection of stress, and now I have to run to the bathroom. And it was really beautiful and amazing to watch that transformation and that recognition of the amount of control that this person had over something they felt they had no control over.
Very nice. Well, that's good to know that, yeah, we can do something even when it seems like we're at the end of the trail. We can do something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's really good to know and a good thing to end on. So I guess we can all be happy and say good night. And Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Tonight. And explaining what a leaky gut is and how we can do something about it.
I'm happy to be of help.
And again, Michelle can be reached on LinkedIn or Facebook, the best ways to get in touch with her.
Yeah, LinkedIn is my name and Facebook is Soaring Phoenix Consulting.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Michelle. It was a pleasure talking to you.
It was a pleasure speaking to you. I hope you have a good evening.
You too. Good night.
Good night.